Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, episode number 99, with Lane Kawaoka on syndicating capital for apartment complex deals. I am Dan Breslin, host of the REI Diamond Show, and on today's discussion with Lane, we cover his transition from single-family houses to raising capital to participate in larger apartment complex transactions. Like many real estate investors, Lane began buying single-family rentals for cash flow to replace his income, only to discover that the pathway was flawed. It just takes too many units, and there are too many recurring expenses to efficiently replace income using rental properties without buying 50 or maybe 100 units. This is the exact reason I personally decided to invest most of my career into flipping and wholesaling properties for large chunks of cash in the short term, and viewing my rental portfolio more like a savings account than a source of income. Enough about my business, though. Let's jump into today's discussion with Lane. All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, Lane. How are you doing today?
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I'm recording from Chicago. A lot of my listeners are used to me warning about the sound of the waves. The waves are big outside the condo today, so if you hear something staticky, that may be the issue, and I cannot actually get that edited out, so my apologies. But where are you recording from today, Lane? Where out in the world?
I'm in Honolulu, Hawaii.
All right. Is Honolulu a fun place to grow up? I've never been, and you know, that's kind of like the vacation destination of fantasy for many of us mainlanders. Is that, how was it growing up there?
I think it is. I mean, it's pretty, you know, the weather is nice every day out here. Can't complain with that. It's very expensive. You know, you look at it on paper, median home out here is $700,000 or so. But you know, everybody drives Toyotas and Hondas, so they get by.
Nice. So Lane, for listeners who probably don't know who you are already, can you give us a little bit of background, what you did, how you got started in real estate, and what your business looks like today?
Yeah, so I went to school, studied hard. I was on that linear path of go get a job, became an engineer out of college, started working, and, again, just followed that dogma of go buy a primary residence to go and live in. But because I was traveling all the time, I was never home, so I became an accidental landlord when I realized that I could rent this thing out for $2,200 and my mortgage is just $1,600. And to a young 20-year-old kid, that was a lot of beer money. So I realized I needed to just do this again and again and again, and things kind of snowballed from there. That's how I got started.
So you're an engineer still working now, or have you given up the day job?
I'm still working. You know, I stopped working for private companies, kind of found jobs that are a little bit more quality of life, give me some free time to do the real estate on the side, which is sort of becoming going to be the full-time gig here, I believe, for the next few years.
All right. Fair enough. So you are a fellow podcaster, and I did a little research, but I'm sure that the listeners haven't on, you know, a lot of the deals you've done to date. Can you tell us what your, you know, business activities in real estate comprise of, you know, in the last, like, let's say 30 to 90 days? What are some of the deals you've done to give us an example of where you're focusing your time?
Yeah, so today I do apartment syndication, and I was looking for mobile homes and self-storage. Basically, you know, good operators who I can infuse my investors' capital into. So I am a syndicator. But you know, it didn't really start from there. You know, a few years ago, I had this idea to make this podcast because everybody was asking me, at the time I was buying turnkey rentals out of state, and I just kind of wrote about it and talked about it, and it kind of snowballed from there, like anything. And, you know, probably in about year, I just started to realize that I could, you know, people, I had this big investor list and people wanted to invest in what I invested in. So that's kind of how I created my business today.
Gotcha. Why don't we touch on the out-of-state turnkey? I'm going to circle back around, and we're going to focus on the syndication in a few minutes. But let's talk about how did you come to the decision to invest out-of-state? I guess a $700,000 medium home in Hawaii doesn't allow for a whole lot of cash flow. Maybe it does on some Airbnb thing, but the way I'm doing deals, it doesn't. What led to your decision? Why did you start investing in places that you couldn't drive down the street and check on your tenants any day of the week?
Yeah, so I first started investing in Seattle. I bought that first rental, like I said, and then I bought a duplex in Seattle. More of a – the first rental was an A-class rental by far. The second one, I realized that, hey, I could get a little bit more cash flow if I went down in the spectrum, so I bought an A-minus, B-plus duplex in Seattle. But then that was about, 2010, 2011, and then 2012 I had saved up another chunk of money to go buy another rental. But then I realized that, hey, the market was rebounding at that point, and the rent to value ratios weren't there for me to cash flow. I think it was probably about a 0.8% rent to value in 2012 in Seattle. I mean, now it's well worse than that today, obviously. But in 2012, I saw the writing on the wall, and I thought my investing was over because none of this stuff cash flowed. But then, I started Googling and kind of stumbled upon this out-of-state rental thing. And, I bought one to try it out. And my first one was in Birmingham. And then I was, pretty much sold on the concept that, you should invest for cash flow, not appreciation. So I traded a couple of those Seattle rentals for 9 out of state in Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis in the coming years.
Okay, so it was a definite decision to go into another state for the cash flow. Is there any underlying appreciation potential in those deals, and why did you choose those markets specifically?
Not really. I mean, there's the total, national market appreciation. 1-2% a year is what I've been seeing in those kind of boring secondary markets. But that, that wasn't the reason why I did it. I did it for cash flow, because my goal at the time was to replace my W-2 income so I could have the freedom to leave my job and not get paid an active income. So I was like, well, I need cash flow to do that. So that was why I consciously made that decision to go to those type of markets to buy those types of homes.
Gotcha. Yeah, I do myself personally. I have a gentrification investment philosophy. So when it comes to buying my rentals, my main income comes from buying, fixing, selling properties, wholesaling properties. We do a high volume of that, 25, 35, 45, 50 deals a month. At one time, I think we had like 110 properties on our whiteboards here throughout all the markets. And then when I'm going to buy something, I like to find areas that I believe are going to double in value in the course of the next 7 years. So I like to buy in advance of gentrification, the neighborhoods changing over, places that were typically below the poverty line. And then you have bordering areas that are becoming your B and A neighborhoods. And you'll see a lot of private investment in these areas. There's the Beltline in Atlanta. There's South Philly. There's some areas out here. What happened in Chicago with Bucktown and, going up the 94 corridor, Avondale. So I like to buy those areas that make sense for cash flow now, although I don't have to have, say $500 per unit cash flow now. I know that 3 years out, 4 years out, if the trend continues, which I believe it does, I'm looking at areas where I have increased rents and double the values. And so far that's worked out well for me. I'm not a 100 unit landlord guy. I'm not that kind of thing myself. I bought like 13, I think, with that exact criteria. I failed on 2 of those, meaning though they're not in the gentrification. So I cut 2 of those properties off and sold them, or I'm in the process of selling them now. So I do a combination of both. It's interesting to hear the cash flow thing. Now, you hit a wall, I know, from your personal story, Lane, with that strategy, and then had to pivot and do something else, which is why you brought up the apartment syndication. Can you talk about that transition and being forced into doing something else, and why the other opportunity just seemed so much better?
Yeah. I mean, it kind of dovetails what you're talking about. I think what you guys do is, pretty awesome. A lot of myself, my situation, all of my investors, we're high paid professionals. We you know, we have this big salary. We can't really, we don't have time to do other things. So we're more on the passive side. So, you know, to do these, we're buying just turnkey stuff, and, you know, we don't really have the time to do the value add or find distressed deals. I mean, we try and get better, but just don't have, we just can't go all in on it. So that kind of brings me into, like, you know, when you're buying these, you know, $100,000 houses that rent for $1,000, you know, you're going to have the, you know, 50% of it going to expenses. And at the end of the day, you may only have, you know, $200 or $300 of cash flow, if that, you know, especially today, because it just makes more sense for these turnkey providers or flippers to flip it to retail than to sell it to a cheapskate investor like us. But, you know, you do the math, right? Like $300 per property, and you're going to need damn near like 30 or 40 of these things to like reach your freedom number. And I'll tell you, I racked up at least 10 of these things, and in those 10, just to use as a sample size, I had one or two evictions a year, you know, and probably about three or four big events that happened. So, you know, you multiply that by three, now you're talking about an eviction, you know, every couple months, and then at least some big catastrophe that happens every single month. I mean, it's like if you had 10 like sons in the teenage years, one of them's going to go to jail every year. It's just going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you, Lane. Yeah, I'm dealing with the same thing, even in the, I forget what I have, 13, 15 units. It's something like that. A few of them I accidentally bought thinking I was going to do something else, or, you know, got kind of stuck in them. Most of them I bought intentionally. But like you just mentioned, too, I had the luxury of seeing hundreds of deals come across my desk. This is my main job, to be able to even select those couple. And I'm not thrilled with them. I do have good management finally in place, but it's been a lot of headaches to get to that point. And I'll probably not continue on that path and get 100 of them at any point in time.
Yeah.
So you got the pain of the rentals. Was there also a financing issue? I mean, if you run into 10, 12, you have to start doing some commercial financing. It gets harder to buy.
It seems like
a lot of work, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, usually we start out get those Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans, but each person today, as standards today, things do change. You're limited to 10 in your name. So what a lot of guys like to do is to put 10 in their name, 10 in their spouse's name. But, you know, it's kind of just an arbitrary number, in my opinion. I mean, even if you get 20, it just doesn't make sense. And, you know, I started to look into portfolio loans, and usually you're paying a point or two higher an interest rate than the Freddie, which you'd be getting with Freddie Mac. The appraisals that you would get because you're working with like a, you know, seems like you're working with a non-AMC appraiser, like they just kind of gouge you on the appraisal and kind of downgrade the value of the home to get the loan favor more on their side. And, you know, the origination costs are pretty astronomical. You're looking at usually about 2% or more. So it just doesn't make sense.
Are you keeping these properties you have? Did you already sell those properties you have? Or what's the plan?
I'm in the process of unloading my whole entire single family home portfolio. I've got a few of them sold, but, you know, a lot of my rental properties, they're renting for more than 900, you know, they're good B minus and better properties. So they're not junk properties, and it's taking a while to sell. That's why I tell a lot of investors, you know, stay away from the duplexes, triplexes, or quads. Especially if you're, you know, high net worth individual, because you're likely to graduate to syndications and private placements. And, you know, you're going to want to sell those properties. The exit strategy on those duplex, triplex, or quads, yeah, it looks good on paper, but, you know, it's hard to model that exit strategy.
Yeah, it's slow and arduous. I have a friend who's been on the show here, Justin Turner. Previously, and he built 100 plus units in all over the city of Philadelphia. And that was his exact thing. He made the same revelation, I think, that we're going to talk about here in a minute, Lane, where all of a sudden he woke up and realized, oh God, there's no real institutional buyers. There's no quick, large dollar buyers. It's a very limited market for a 100 house portfolio in a city scattered throughout the area. On top of the maintenance costs, the eviction costs, the management to run the whole thing, compared to if he had that same 100 units in one location, you know, with on-site management and staff, with a potential buyer being institutional, larger money funds, other syndicators like yourself to come in and buy that, there's just a much more vibrant market for that 100 units all in one place as opposed to the other. So let's talk about that graduation to syndication and how you made that. Maybe even the first deal where you did that, and back when it was a little bit scary and shaky in a new direction for you. And if you could maybe like talk through a play by play on that deal, I think that might be interesting for us here.
Yeah, I mean, my first deal or two, I think I just went in as a limited partner just to, you know, get some units under my belt, because, you know, you're searching for deals, and a lot of the brokers, I mean, most of the brokers, they're just playing a game of qualification. I mean, they don't really want to touch you unless you've bought something before. So, you know, to jump in as a limited partner on the deal and to try and get, you know, even co-sign on the loan, that's kind of key to get in that general partnership as a key principle. But at least, you know, you can say, hey, I'm in a couple of deals, you know, I own 300 units, you know, technically you only own 1% of those, but hey, you know, it looks good on paper and it gets you to the next stage engaging with a broker. And that's, the deals only go to the people who can close. And, you know, just because you're talking to a broker and, you know, both you guys like the Dallas Mavericks, you know, doesn't mean you're not going to get the deal.
Gotcha. Okay, so you did like two or three of these limited partnerships, and they were your first. The one I'm looking for is the one, did you take lead and were the general partner? Did you find the actual asset, or was it just, is your portion more like assembling the funding and then finding an operating partner to invest? Can you shed light on that?
Yeah, so I joined an apartment mentoring group, which I think is pretty critical to doing it in this business. You know, I don't really recommend it for single family homes, but for multifamily, you know, to just get the loan, you need to have somebody in your team, a partner who's going to sign on your loan or be in your general partnership who has the experience. So it's a chicken and egg thing. So unless you get around people who, you know, have the experience in one of these mentorship groups, I don't know how you can do it. And maybe you're lucky enough to, you know, somebody just takes you under the wing locally, but you know, that was kind of where I was at. I joined the group. I was, you know, did all this training to be an operator, but then I realized, you know, hey, who am I kidding? I live in Honolulu, Hawaii, Seattle at the time. I'm not there to build rapport with the brokers, nor do I even like, you know, dealing with Class C multifamily. I mean, it's hard work. These sponsors and leads get compensated very well. But what I did personally have was I had this network, because I did this silly podcast and I joined all these masterminds. So I knew who all the operators were, and I knew how to underwrite the deals properly, because all these syndicators, you know, they all make the same spreadsheets and they have the same fancy PDFs and the number at the bottom of the page is the same. But it's all the assumptions that are baked into it on, you know, behind the scenes, what levers they're pulling to get that, whatever it is, 17 to 20% a year or 100% in 5 years. I mean, that's really what was my value add. So I realized I need to leverage that, and, you know, people trust in my underwriting. So that's kind of how I went into a deal, and I went and, you know, brought my investors along and, you know, brought funding, and I found good operators, and that's how I kind of added value to the team.
Okay, so can you define the syndicator? I'm kind of like I'm a rube. I don't.
Yeah, so a syndicator is a very, like, ubiquitous term. You know, syndicator, the meaning of the word is someone who pulls a whole bunch of people together. But a syndicator can also mean that you're an operator or a fundraiser. And I think as people move up on the value chain and the food chain of investors, you know, most of us are operators first. You know, we've done single family homes. We've even done some multifamily. And we're the operator. We're the person finding the deal. We're the person finding the investors, the person making all the asset management, managing the manager. But as things move along, I think people need to diverge and realize that they need to take a self-awareness check and say, where are their personal skills most used? Is it in an operator role or is it a fundraiser role? Both of those roles are syndicators.
Got it. So I'm going to ask you a question here on the heels of that. I want you to answer it for me two different ways. The first would be, let's say I'm asking this question from the end of the capital. Like if I'm a high net worth individual, and I ask you, okay, Lane, what is your highest value skill set? How would you answer it the first way?
I'd probably say I'm an engineer. I know the numbers. I know how to underwrite these properties. And I think that's how I would lead. I mean, I'm investing my own money in these deals, so I look at the deal from an investor standpoint too.
And then from the flip side, what's the highest value skill set when you're approaching the operator? Because I believe you said you're more in the fundraising side of things and you're finding these operators. So what would be the highest value skill that you'd have in that realm there?
I bring my investors along because they know, like, and trust my brand. And a lot of what I do is education. I teach people how to underwrite these numbers. And they value that, and they trust it, because I point out things that they never even thought about when they look at these packages.
Do you have any examples of the underwriting that you've done? It sounds like that's a really big value add and a critical skill when you're protecting your capital for your funding partners and your own capital. What would be some of the assumptions that, you know, that were presented in these spreadsheets? I've seen the spreadsheets myself many, many times. What are some that you found the assumptions were off and you said, no, this is not a good deal? And can you explain for me why those assumptions were not correct and why you choose not to invest in that deal?
Yeah. So, I mean, first, in a nice shiny PDF, you're never getting any of the rent rolls. You're never getting any of the P&Ls. And you need to do your own due diligence on the comps. You know, if they're saying they're getting 90 cents a square foot today and they're going to bump it to 111 cents, you need to go verify that. You know, things like the whole sales comp page, I just throw that out. That has nothing to do with anything. Multifamily apartments is all to do with NOI. It doesn't nobody any good what the other property sold next to it or what was the price per unit. So to get specifically, you know, just some things off the top of my head, you know, some people underwrite with, you know, assuming that the rents are going to go up 4 or 5% every single year. You know, that's a recipe for disaster. You know, you should be using something like 2% every year or expenses per year. You know, usually you like to see that very high because that gives you room for error. And you want to see it like a $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 per unit per year. You know, it's something to spot check. And just to give you a third one off the top of my head, I see a lot of rent increases. You know, if something is, you know, if average units are 500 and they're saying they're going to raise it to 700, you know, I would say anything that is bumping the rents up 20% or even 15% and not in a not hot market like Dallas or, you know, one of Austin, I would say you're smoking crack with that. I don't know how you're going to get that without modeling like very, very huge vacancy, you know, and, you know, those are just three big ones. But it's all a big picture, right? Because, okay, you know, you're modeling 15% rent increases, but let me see your occupancy curve, you know. Are you showing 20% and 25% the next year, or are you just kind of humming it along at 15% occupant or vacancy? You know, I mean, not saying that those are like the curves that you should be modeling, but I want to take a look at that. It's one of those things that you just have to analyze 100 to 200 of these properties the right way with a, you know, somebody who knows what they're doing, kind of watching over your shoulder.
Do you have an example for me of how you figured out or confirmed, let's say, some rent bump assumptions?
Yeah, so verifying your comps, like that's like 90% of like the value add, right? You want to go around and you want to get comps from other properties that will affirm that, hey, your business plan, if we go and do these minor upgrades, these $3,000-$4,000 of upgrades in each unit, that we're going to get this higher rent. So the way, first way to do that, you know, because time is money. You can't go and mystery shop every single property. You pull up a CoStar report, or you go online and you kind of figure out, try and find like a same, like, you know, dated property. So if you're working with a 1975 property, maybe try and find a 1979 or 1974 property that's very similar, and kind of shop them on the internet. But then ultimately you've got to go there and put a hoodie on and make like you're a tenant and see what the real prices are and feel and get a feel for the property, you know, because when sometimes when you go in the units, you know, you're like, oh, this is way bigger, you know, or the ceilings are way higher, or there's two pools here and this one has none. Or you just stand in the parking lot, you just get a different feel.
Hmm.
So that's the only way you can verify that these comps are right.
When you underwrite a property, when you underwrite a deal, an operator, et cetera, do you actually physically, Lane, hop on a plane and visit every one of these deals you put your money in?
No. But eventually I do go and check it out. I mean, that's kind of a, for sure, I will go and check it out once I'm in the deal. But, you know, once you analyze enough of these and you visit enough of it, you know, they all look alike, you know. I mean, 1980s, 150 unit garden style property. I mean, once you've seen one, you've kind of seen them all and you can kind of get a feel for it. I think one of the biggest thing is to grow your network. So you have people on the ground that, you know, are good friends that can, you know, visit properties for you. And, you know, you have a lot of data points and you can kind of bounce ideas off of. You know, it's not something that you're going to have in the first year or two of doing this, but. Yeah, I think that saves for a lot of airplane travel.
Yeah, you're right about that. Of the, you know, of the 50 or 60 or so deals that I have on the board right now, I think I've physically been inside of one of all those deals, maybe two of all those deals. I've never even seen, you know, with the exception of one of my rental properties, I don't think I've ever seen any of the other ones. So it's the same thing. I'm able to trust the guys on the ground who are, in a sense, my operating partners, like they would be in your deals. Lane, Rolodex of operating partners. Do you have a handful of go-to operators that you're typically putting these deals together, or are you rolling out the carpet and continuously interviewing and reviewing deals from a myriad of operators?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, people, you know, operators are kind of coming out of the woodwork and kind of getting connected with me. And I just get a weird feeling when people start pitching me the deal that they have. You know, don't come to me when you have a deal. Come to me to build a relationship. You know, I'm not going to jump in your deal in the first few months of meeting you, especially if it's not like in person. And, you know, I've kind of got enough deal flow where I'm to the point where I'm not going to work with anybody I don't know, like, or trust, or have one degree of separation with. So that's a big thing. I need to be friends with somebody who has been in that previous deal that I can trust. Not like, oh, I heard from this guy that he was good, or everybody's using this guy. Like, no, I'm not going to put my brand on the line for that. And I agree with you.
People are going to look at you.
You know, the way you guys do it, like when I was buying single family homes, I wouldn't go visit them. But, you know, some of these multifamilies, if I'm not familiar with the area, yeah, it does warrant a site visit.
So there are cases when you will say, you know what, I got to go out there and see this one for some odd reason.
Right. But, you know, now when my investor network kind of all over the place, you know, I can kind of just shoot out an email and, you know, hey, is there anybody in Huntsville? I just need a, you know, 5-minute chat. Let's talk about this.
Let's talk about, like, maybe an example avatar deal do you have. Are these a buy and hold forever? Are they a buy, hold for 5 years, then resell, refinance? Maybe you could give us an example of what some individual investor's capital contribution was, their return throughout that deal, and maybe if you had an exit strategy on that same example, what it was that they ended up, how they exited, and what their profit and, you know, end return with the return of capital look like. Do you have an example like that you could share specifically without naming your investor, but in mind having him as our avatar?
Yeah. I mean, you know, for most, sophisticated multifamily investors, you know, we all kind of know the gold standard these days for returns are kind of in that 15 to 20% IRR range, or, you know, 80 to 100% returns in 5 years. So if you put in 50 grand into a deal, you'd get back your 50 grand and another 50 grand in 5 years. Of course, you know, things are a lot harder these days. You know, deals aren't as, you know, as good as they were a few years ago. So, you know, that 100% return in 5 years, that double your money in 5 years is harder to come by. I would also say that, you know, if you see that, you may question the underwriting, that they may be even stretching to even get that. Because you tweak one number, you know, you change the reversion cap rate half a point. You change a 70% return in 5 year deal to 100% return in 5 year in some cases. So it's very manipulated. But, you know, normally these things take about 5 years, you know, because you're going in there, you're rehabbing the units. A lot of the properties that I'll invest in, they're 90% occupied. So none of these properties that are hugely vacant. And the reason I like to do that is I like the non-recourse loans. Those Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loans, the government subsidized loans that you can kind of walk away from if, you know, things go bad. So usually it takes about a year or two to do all the rehab. And you're doing it as the natural vacancies come up. You're not kind of forcing anybody out. And that takes a while. And then another year or two to kind of change the rent profile, because you're changing the community here. Usually you're buying something that either the management's not the greatest or under renting the units out, and you're trying to change that, and that takes another year or two, and then finally last year to sell it and stabilize the books for the next buyer. So in all, it takes about 5 years to reposition. Now there's two main business plans. The first is the pump and dump 5 years, like what I kind of just mentioned. But another one is, you know, maybe you'll refinance the thing in 3 to 4 years. So get a bridge loan on the front, take a little bit of risk then, and then do a refinance in 3 to 4 years, get all your investors' original capital out, and now they're in for sort of quote-unquote infinite returns after that. And that's kind of a more of a legacy hold. And, you know, different investors want different things. You know, smart investors, some will want, you know, the legacy hold. Some will just want their pump and dump five-year deals, and so they can go off to another deal and make even more money. I think at the end of the day, you know, I always ask the question, like, what's the five-year return? Just to compare apples to apples.
All right. The next question I have is apartment risk in general. Let's say a couple things. Let's say the age of population, perhaps of millennials starting to buy properties. Maybe let's say the overbuilding of multifamily apartment units in specific cities. And the third example, maybe I'm just throwing out there, and I don't know if you have any insight on any of these three, the interest rate, the multifamily changing, and then the economics of the general economy changing. What are the risks that you view as could be troublesome to the whole sector, or maybe certain cities or red flags that you would stay away from because of some of those risks, like population trends that I just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't believe in the whole millennial thing buying a house. I mean, that's good for them that can afford it. But I mean, look at the demographics. America's population is growing, and, you know, we have a big immigrant population who are going to live in apartments. I mean, it just makes so much sense. People aren't going to be buying houses or renting out houses because there's just not enough of them. It's all going to be in apartments. I mean, just look how Asia is. I mean, everybody lives in apartments there just because of the population growth and the divide in the wealth gap. So I'm not too concerned there in terms of, you know, apartments as a sector. The other thing you mentioned, the economy. Now, you know, as investors, you make money off of the cap rate, the difference between the cap rate and the interest rate. So I don't buy the whole argument, oh, you need to buy now because interest rates are low. Well, I mean, when interest rates go up, so should the cap rate. So, you know, investors know that, like I said, you make the money on the difference between the interest rate and the cap rate, and you're using leverage so you can multiply that. Now, in certain situations, like I think we had in early 2016 and you know, we might be having this now where you have a phenomenon called cap rate compression, where the interest rates spike up, you know, quarter point, half a point in a short period of time. And then the prices of the home, you know, they kind of just stay correlated, or they may even go up, or the cap rates, you know, kind of follow that. So the difference between the interest rates and the cap rates compress, and that's why you hear the term cap rate compression, and that's what that means. So in that case, you know, that's cap rate compression, is that's your money to make, and that gets compressed. So in those short periods of time, that's not a good time to be buying. And you just need to know what's a good deal, and kind of stick to your underwriting and stick to your standards to avoid a deal like that. But in terms of geographic areas, you know, and most of the apartment investors are kind of moving to the southern states, so, you know, to follow that blue collar job growth. You know, Texas has been on fire. You know, Dallas, everybody knows about Dallas. A lot of sophisticated apartment investors have stopped looking in Dallas because it's just too overheated. They're kind of moving to San Antonio, Houston, some even tertiary markets these days. So it's just harder and harder to find deals. I mean, that's why I'm kind of looking outside of the multifamily sector too. As much as I like multifamily, as you know, everybody needs a place to live, and a lot of them are the lower demographics. A lot of investors are coming into multifamily, and I always tell people who, you know, want to get into syndication and raising money, which I help people do, if you want to do it, and the easiest place to do is multifamily, because every single Tom, Dick, Jane, and Harry who invest in real estate own single family homes. And eventually they're going to get to a point where they're like, well, I want multiple of these things. So they're going to go into apartments. And it's really easy to tell that story to investors who have already, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid. But I believe that it's getting overcrowded, and I don't think it's a bad idea to diversify into like mobile home parks, self-storage, assisted living, and then just get a little bit more diversified in terms of asset classes.
Are you at all nervous about the cap rate compression in deals that you are already in, let's say in year one or year two, and then we witnessed the cap rates rising and we were looking for an exit strategy 3 years from now? Are there any situations like that?
But usually you model the cap rate to kind of go up on you in your reversion cap rate, which is the exit. So you kind of account for that a little bit. But, you know, once you get that loan and once you buy the property, you've kind of locked in. That's why it's important to, you know, get longer term financing, you know, at least a 7 year, you know, 10 to 12 year would be more preferred. But, you know, the people that get into trouble and sell these as a fire sale, the guys getting those short-term notes, those five-year notes. And what happens is, you know, if there's a downturn in the economy, that five-year note is sort of, think of it like a ladder. It should bridge you to the next upturn, or at least have you sell, you know, higher or better where you're at. So, I mean, if you take a five-year note out today, I mean, look, there's going to be a correction coming, and that five-year ladder might be too short. I'd rather have that 10-year ladder to bridge me over to that, you know, at least we'd be coming up, you know, higher. And that's the good thing about buying these cash flowing properties. You know, if there's a downturn, well, great. You know, we can just hold on for cash flow. I mean, we'll be a lot better than everybody else.
So the hedge against that risk is to get longer financing than 5 years, say 7, 10, 12 years. That's pretty much a good hedge against the risk of a downturn.
Right. The risk is there. The risk is there, but it's a way of mitigating it. That.
Okay, great. What's your day-to-day contribution to your business now, Lane? What do you do when you wake up in the morning on a Tuesday morning through the afternoon?
I just look for deals. Just keep networking with operators. Get, you know, try and add value to people. You know, it's all relationships at the end of the day.
If you had somebody you looked up to that you would consider like the most successful real estate investor, or maybe a developer, could be somebody that you actually know, dead or alive, but the important aspect of the question that I'm asking is why you believe they are successful.
I don't really have one person I think of. I usually see, you know, most people as, you know, they have a variety of skill sets and they have a variety of faults. I think sort of my key to success is kind of look at a lot of people and see what they're doing well, and kind of take note of what they're not doing well and kind of emulate the good and kind of take a self-awareness check. Are you doing those bad things yourself? Yeah, I think everybody, you know, everybody can admit that, you know, there's things that they can improve on. There's no one that's perfect. But I do think that the people who are doing this the right way, the thing that I kind of key in on is like their integrity. You know, just the way they present themselves, they're not all about sales. They're more about relationships and people. And, you know, it's easy to do that when you're financially free. I think, you know, when people are working for money, I think that's, I kind of shy away from those people. You know, I just don't care to work with folks like that, because as soon as the money goes away or things get tough, they burn the relationship because it doesn't mean anything to them. I want people who are kind of in for it because not because they need the money, because they think it's fun and it's fun to work with me.
Nice. Do you have two or three books you have maybe recommended most often?
You know, I'm not a really big book guy. You know, I tell everybody to read that Millionaire Real Estate Investor by Gary Keller. It has a lot of good fundamentals, but I'm like, man, stop reading books, you know, go out and analyze 100 properties.
If you could go back, let's say, how long have you been doing the real estate thing now, Lane? 10, 12 years?
Oh, 10 years.
Okay, let's go back 10 years. If you could share the crown jewel of wisdom with your, I guess you were like, what, 20, 21-year-old self there when you first got started, what would that be?
I would tell myself to kind of keep doing what I did. You know, I played my cards well, I feel like. And whenever I talk to somebody, I try and get a sense of what resources they're working with. And those three are time, money, and how much knowledge or network they have and whether their skill sets are. And based on that, that there's a strategy that usually works for them the best, whether it's single family homes, wholesaling, flipping, apartment syndication, mobile home parks. There's usually one that kind of fits best. I never really had a mentor starting out. I wish I had one. It kind of pointed me in the right direction. I kind of fumbled, and I think I got really lucky meeting the right people and kind of doing the right things. But I would tell myself, keep building that capital and keep just adding value to people. You know, a lot of people, they kind of call, and I tell people, don't be an ask-hole. You know, find a way to add value. Don't just ask question after question after question. I've done enough of these like free coaching calls to know that, and because I back check them, I figure out, I do these like weird beta tests or split tests. And I'm like, the people who ask the questions incessantly, those guys never make it. But the guys who add value and they're like, oh, you know, hey, I noticed you needed this, let me go and do it for you. Those are the guys who climb the ladder very quickly.
Yeah, that really is a great point, the adding value piece. I know that's the reason I do this show, is to add value to my network. I never sell any coaching or products or things of that nature. I really don't have anything like that that I'm doing. This is strictly to add value to the guests, to the audience, to myself through conversations like we just had here. And we had a gentleman, his name is Austin Stack. He's actually my vice president for the Atlanta market now. And I remember, and some of the listeners know I've mentioned this story, but he just continued to add value. He was, I forget, 22, 23. He was young. He came into our networking event in Chicago. He had no idea what he was doing in the business. He's sending me listed properties, trying to, you know, oh, yeah, I'm wholesaling. And he's like sending me listed on the MLS properties. And it was kind of, that was his like best, you know, gesture at adding value at the time. But he then sent, you know, he moved to Atlanta and he sends me like his whole buyers list from Chicago, all the network he had built up in Chicago. He just sent it. No, you know, hey, do you want to buy it? Hey, I want to get paid if one of these guys buy. No, like looking for anything just to add value. And it got to the point where it was like, you know, I had to call him up and say, hey, when are you coming back to Chicago? We had lunch.
Yeah.
And that's when we ended up doing the Atlanta market. So.
Right. I mean, someone in your shoes has so much value to give, and you're just, I think you're just looking for a good, you know, good integrity, right? Like I think maybe sending your whole entire buyer's list or giving up your whole entire virtual assistant roster isn't the smartest thing to do, but it says something about the character, right? The character is the most important thing. A lot of people will be like, okay, Dan and Lane said to like add value. Okay, Dan, I'm going to give you this because I want this in exchange. Like, no, everybody knows it sees right through that bullshit. Like, be a good person.
Yeah, absolutely. And he also, with any of the people that I partner on deals with, I kind of ask myself this question, Lane. I say, hey, if this person had $100,000 of my money with nothing more than a handshake in their account and they left the country for a week or 2 weeks or something like that, would I be able to sleep at night while they were gone? And if the answer is yes, then I can move forward with potentially doing business. If I have any hesitation that my money is in danger, and depending on where you're at, that number could be $10,000 of your money, or that could be $5 million of your money with a handshake, depending on the size of the deals that you're working with or the comfort level you're used to. But that's the little question I ask myself.
Right. And to your point, like, you know, when I go into a deal, especially because I'm in the general partnership, you know, I put a lot of faith in a lot of the partners. And if I don't have the feeling where, like, if this guy, you know, kind of runs off with your money or does something shady, if I don't get the feeling, I'm like, there is absolutely no chance of that happening. Like, I will, like, question humanity if this guy, like, does this. Like, then I won't do the deal. like, if there's any doubt, I would just run away.
Absolutely. So, Lane, if anyone is listening, wants to get some more information about you, do you have a website or contact information you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah. They can go to simplepassivecashflow.com, check out the podcast, Simple Passive Cashflow, iTunes, Google Play, all those. And then if they want to get in contact with me, my email is lane@simplepassivecashflow.com.
All right, cool. Well, hey, I appreciate your time. I know you're busy. I appreciate you coming on the show. I had a ton of great notes myself. I had a really good time having a conversation, discussion with you today, Lane.
Yeah. Nice meeting you too, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving an email notification when a future episode of the show is released? You can either sign up at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Do you have investment capital not already earning above average returns? If you are interested in checking out upcoming private mortgage investment opportunities I have available in the Chicago, Atlanta, Florida, and Philadelphia markets, go to superchargedreturns.com. Most of these private mortgage investment opportunities are short-term, 3 to 6 month deals, with capital often being returned to investors in 30 to 60 days, which is nice. You'll also receive instant access to the audio on how to create tax-free real estate investments. And at that website, you will also find links to available investment properties. Finally, if you have certain questions or topics you'd like discussed on a future episode, or maybe you have a guest suggestion or just want to reach out and say hello, you can contact me by clicking on the Contact Dan link at www.reidiamonds.com. Thanks again for being a loyal listener of the show. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.